You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, more Americans are getting diagnosed with sleep apnea. Two sleep doctors join us now to talk about how to diagnose and treat that condition. That's coming up in a couple minutes. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Sarah Hopeful with a story about a musician who played a big role in Wisconsin's musical history.
Drummer Viola Smith was a musical trailblazer and innovator. Known as the fastest girl drummer in the world, her career lasted almost 100 years. Author Dean Robbins took a trip to her hometown in Fond du Lac County to tell us more about this legend.
Mount Calvary has only a few hundred residents, but it produced a drummer of national significance. She was born in 1912, and if you stop modern-day residents on the main drag, they still know her name.
Viola Smith.
Viola Smith's father owned a ballroom in Mount Calvary, and townsfolk showed me where it once stood on Fond du Lac Street. Mr. Smith enlisted his older daughters for the jazzy Smith Sisters Orchestra, featuring trumpet, trombone, and saxophone. By the time Viola was ready to join the family band at age 13, she told the Women in Rock Oral History Project that it still lacked a key instrument.
And he had these eight girls all play piano, and then he'd put them on different instruments. And I was so lucky to be the sixth one. As a sixth one, I was a drummer.
Young Viola tried smacking the snare and socking the cymbals, and she fell in love with the drums. The Smith sisters went on the road in the 1920s as a rare all-female band at Wisconsin fairs and vaudeville theaters. Viola studied other drummers on the circuit and developed her own flashy way of playing. One by one, Viola's sisters left music for other pursuits. But she yearned to keep playing, even though female instrumentalists were not welcome in most male orchestras. So in 1939, Smith formed her own women's jazz band called the Coquettes to showcase her razzle-dazzle style. She placed her 12-piece kit on a tall platform with a giant tom-tom by each shoulder. This innovation wowed the crowds when Smith rapped out rhythms at blazing speed. To end the numbers with a flourish, she bounced her sticks off a drum head and caught them in midair. Smith's fame spread as a technical marvel, earning her the nickname the fastest girl drummer in the world. In 1940, Billboard magazine splashed her on its cover. She remembers that time with the Women in Rock Oral History Project.
That I was doing something that nobody else was doing, and that's what helped me a lot, I'm sure.
In 1942, men were leaving jazz bands to fight in World War II, and Smith saw a chance to boost women instrumentalists. She wrote an influential article for Downbeat magazine called Give Girl Musicians a Break. It urged band leaders to hire these overlooked players.
Oh, the girl musicians were so happy about this because I mentioned so many girl names, all the girls I knew. Good musicians.
Smith later toured as a solo act with a spectacular 17-piece drum kit. She even studied classical music at Juilliard and joined the National Symphony Orchestra as a timpanist. In 2000, Lincoln Center for the Arts honored her as a jazz legend. Smith continued to smack her snare and sock her cymbals past the age of 100, defying our conventional view of older women. She died in 2020 at the age of 107, a hero to generations of female instrumentalists who followed her into the music business. It's no wonder people still know Viola Smith's name in Mount Calvary. Who could forget the fastest girl drummer in the world?
It was all fun, but drumming is fun.
Author Dean Robbins of Madison brought us that story on Viola Smith. He's written a children's picture book about the musician, the fastest drummer. Clap your hands for Viola Smith. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
This is Central Time. Obstructive sleep apnea is a common condition for many Americans. According to some estimates, as many as 30 million people could have it. But a lot of those 30 million may not know they have it. Sleep apnea disrupts breathing at night and leads to poor sleep quality and can lead to other health conditions. But a lot of people go undiagnosed for years. Two doctors who specialize in sleep medicine join us now. They're here to help us understand the risk factors, diagnosis, and treatment for sleep apnea. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have sleep apnea yourself? Was it easy to get diagnosed? Did it take a while? Do you use a CPAP machine at night? How has that affected the quality of your sleep? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Tarif Samadi is a pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist with Aurora Healthcare. Dr. Samadi, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Stacey Ishman is a pediatric ear, nose, and throat doctor and sleep surgeon at UW Health. Dr. Ishman, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Samadi, can you give us the basics on sleep apnea, especially this most common kind, obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA? What is going on when we have that?
As you've alluded to earlier, obstructive sleep apnea is a very common condition. It really affects a huge segment of the population worldwide. It's estimated to be around 20 to 30% of the general population in some studies. And it tends to span all the spectrum of ages, from children all the way to the elderly. And obstructive sleep apnea is the most common type of apneas by definition. And basically, there is a narrowing of the upper airway, which is the anatomical space starting with the nasal airway all the way to the tongue level behind the tongue base specifically. So during wakefulness, the airway is always maintained open through some muscle groups and toning of that airway through directly controlling it neurologically. However, in individuals who have obstructive sleep apnea, sleep state kicks in, the tone of the airway and the patency of the airway becomes compromised to a level where there is a cessation of airflow sometimes, and that's how the breathing is affected.
And Dr. Ishman, what is that going to look and sound and feel like for that person? What are some of the earliest warning signs that, hey, I might have sleep apnea?
Yeah, so what's interesting about this is it's totally different in adults and kids. I think we're all familiar with the roommate who snores too loud and maybe makes it hard for you to sleep. That's very typical in adults. Oftentimes they may have gasping or pausing in their breathing, and oftentimes morning headaches. They may feel tired during the day. That's really typical for adults. For kids, they might actually be hyperactive. It is the rare child who will tell you that they're tired in the morning. My children will fall asleep swearing that they're not tired. And so it's interesting that it looks different in those two groups, but pausing, gasping, choking, and daytime sleepiness are really, really significant findings for sleep apnea.
And Dr. Samadi, a disrupted sleep, that's bad enough in and of itself. I understand that sleep apnea can raise risks for serious health conditions down the line. What are some of our worries of long-term untreated apnea?
Yes, absolutely. In multiple studies now, it's been confirmed that sleep apnea drives significant risk for cardiovascular disease in general. The strongest link is to elevated blood pressure or hypertension. There are increased risks for cardiovascular events in general, from heart attacks, congestive heart failure, arrhythmias, even the risk for stroke is higher. Not to mention, there are the rare cases where there's sometimes sudden death during sleep due to severe sleep apnea.
Dr. Ishman, suppose somebody comes into the doctor reporting some of these symptoms. What are some of the next steps toward diagnosis?
So one thing I want to add is that in kids, oftentimes it's school performance and some other things. So in adults, I totally agree with everything that Dr. Samadi said. But when you think about next steps, really diagnosis is key. So I think Dr. Samadi mentioned that there's a number of conditions that can cause similar daytime symptoms. It may be that you're looking at hyperactivity, which can overlap with this. And maybe you're looking at congestive heart failure, which can overlap with this. And so a sleep study is really the first thing for us to figure out what's exactly going on with a patient and to differentiate obstructive versus other diseases in terms of sleep apnea.
We are talking about sleep apnea. Dr. Stacy Ishman is with us from UW Health. Dr. Tarif Samadi from Aurora Healthcare. We're looking at how sleep apnea is diagnosed, what it can do to you, and coming up, how we treat it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this the story of your life? Are you or is someone close to you dealing with sleep apnea? What were some of the first signs? What did it take to get diagnosed? Have you found treatment that seems to be helping? Join in now with your experiences or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Dr. Tarif Samadi from Aurora Healthcare, Dr. Stacy Ishman from UW Health, both sleep specialists. We're looking at the risks of sleep apnea, how it's diagnosed and treated. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use a CPAP machine? Has that affected the quality of your life? Have you tried a different alternative? What questions do you have about sleep apnea? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I have sleep apnea, and I'm wondering about this new gadget, I guess you could call it. It's called Inspire, and it's implanted in the shoulder, and they said you don't have to wear a mask or anything because you use this instead. What can you tell me about it?
Okay, thanks for the call. Dr. Samadi, let's start with you. I had seen a write-up on this. I hadn't heard of this before, but this implant to treat sleep apnea, what do we know about it?
Yes, the hypoglossal nerve stimulator, as we call it, is an FDA-approved option for a selected group of obstructive sleep apnea patients. So there is a specific criteria that patients must meet in order to be considered for this specific therapy. And while it is effective, the data suggests that there are weight limits. Patients have to be within specific BMI range. There's also specific anatomical descriptions that have to be met based on examination using sedated endoscopy. So it's not for every patient. And CPAP, on the other hand, remains superior and more universal. Now, the specifics about the hypoglossal nerve stimulator, it is a generator that is implanted under the chest wall, typically on the right side of the chest wall, similar to a pacemaker. And the ENT surgeon will connect this generator with the hypoglossal nerve, which sits right under the chin on both sides. We only stimulate one side, typically the right side, and this is activated via remote control that the patient have access to. And when they're ready to fall asleep, they simply turn it on. And electrical stimulation at a very low voltage is delivered to the hypoglossal nerve that controls the largest tongue muscle.
Wow.
And that's how the therapy works, by advancing the tongue in a more forward position, keeping the airway more open.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Ishman, Dr. Samadi referenced the CPAP. Now, some people out there are very, very familiar with the CPAP, probably because they use it every night. For people who aren't, can you tell us a little bit about the CPAP, what it does, what it is?
Sure. Although I will say I'm actually an ENT surgeon who places Inspire. So
oh, you do?
It's interesting. Yeah, so... interesting. So really useful.
How common is it since you're doing these surgeries that people are getting that?
Yeah, I think it's actually becoming more and more common, but I think Dr. Samadi's comment that there's a select group where it works the best for is a really good one. And it's people who are in a BMI under 35 and who have between 15 and 100 events an hour of obstructive sleep apnea. And so there are plenty of reasons that CPAP is really, really, really useful. And I think his comment about when you can use it, it is more effective than anything else out there. And so the contrast is really great. I'm also a sleep medicine physician in addition to an ENT. And so I have lots of patients who have come to me for the Inspire, and we've done some procedures, mostly nasal, so that they can breathe better through their nose and use their CPAP more effectively. And about half of people who get a CPAP use it really effectively, and about half have some challenges. And so we work really hard to make sure that that technology works, because it can be very effective. But when it's not effective, something like the Inspire can be really useful if you meet the criteria. And so he made a really good point. You have to make sure that both your sleep study and weight, honestly, make you a good candidate. But it can be really a great salvage therapy, meaning if you can't use some other things like dental appliances or CPAP, it can work great, including in the group with Down syndrome, which is the latest group that's been approved for its use.
And Dr. Schmidt, I want to stay with you in surgery for a moment. I, as a teenager, had deviated septum surgery. It wasn't the most fun few weeks of my life, but is that something that we do to help with some cases of apnea?
So most of the data shows that if you do nasal surgery, like a deviated septum, or there's bones in our nose called turbinates, which we can make smaller, that is really effective in helping us use CPAP better. There is some pediatric data that suggests if you do that surgery, you can reduce the number of pauses an hour you have by up to 10 events an hour. And there's an adult meta-analysis that also suggests up to 11 events an hour, but most adults have far more than that. And so we don't really characterize sleep surgery as nasal surgery. We think it really helps use sleep CPAP for people who don't have sleep apnea, but actually the snore can really reduce snoring. So it can make your spouse much happier or your friends who live with you. But it is predominantly something that we use to make it easier to use other therapies.
Let's go back to our callers. Kathy is with us in Chippewa Falls. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share, it took a while for me to convince my husband he needed a sleep study, but his snoring would rattle the windows and kept me awake. And I did notice that he would stop breathing. He finally got one. And it's made a world of difference. The snoring is gone. And the one thing that we didn't expect to happen was he used to get up and go to the bathroom maybe three or four times a night. And that stopped. So we are both now getting a full night's sleep, and it's fabulous.
And does he, and I guess you too, Kathy, feel better in the daytime too because of that?
I love it. Yeah.
Kathy.
Yeah, I'm so happy that he finally went ahead with it.
Thanks so much for sharing that. I have some relatives who do CPAP, Dr. Samadi. It can be a real life-changing event when you get this thing, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's like you described it. It is a life changer. And the majority of CPAP users, when they are able to tolerate it, they report improvement. And that, of course, is subjective and varies tremendously between different patients. But in general, the outcome is always excellent.
Thanks again for the call, Kathy. Dr. Ishman, you work with kids. I imagine it might be difficult at the early going to get a kid to adjust and be willing to wear that CPAP. What does it take to make that happen?
You know, I'm going to be honest. I think we just worry they're going to be hard doing it. the compliance rate in kids is pretty much the same as the compliance rate in adults. And in fact, in kids with Down syndrome, it's slightly higher than it is in adults. So it turns out our kids listen to us. Don't tell my kids. They don't listen to me. But what really I think happens is it's about the attitude of the caregiver. So if you're optimistic about it working, I think you're much more likely to get kids to be able to use it.
Excellent. Now, are there lifestyle changes, Dr. Samadi, that we can do maybe for a milder apnea condition that doesn't rise to the level of a CPAP? Are there sleep hygiene things that we can do that might make a difference?
Yes, absolutely. Some of the tips we tell our patients to do is always emphasize the benefit of weight loss. While this is a difficult goal to achieve for a lot of people, but it's still useful. Even if it's few pounds, it can make a big difference in the severity and the burden of snoring and apnea. Also, avoiding sleeping supine or on the back, that is also very protective, because when we are on our backs, we're more prone and vulnerable to obstructive sleep apnea. So sleeping side, favoring a side is also helpful. And the last thing that I can add is we tell patients to try to sleep with the head of the bed slightly elevated. That also reduces the gravity effect on the tongue, allowing for more open airway.
And Dr. Ishman, just a half minute left. Can you give some encouragement to people who might be on the fence of whether they should get that sleep study?
No, absolutely. I think that the most important thing is to understand what's going on. So if you're snoring versus sleep apnea, very different options for treatment. Figure it out, whether it's your partner that you're poking to get out of bed or your child who you're worried is not doing as well in school. I think it's really critical to understand what's going on with their sleep. So thank you so much for giving us the time to talk.
And thanks to both of our guests. We've been talking to Dr. Stacey Ishman, pediatric ear, nose, and throat doctor and sleep surgeon at UW Health, and Dr. Tarif Samadi, pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist at Aurora Healthcare. Been talking about sleep apnea, how it's diagnosed, how it can affect us, and various kinds of treatment. Still time for you to share your story. If you have one, you can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.